Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas, the arts editor of the TLS, and I'm flying solo this week, so the chatting with myself part might be a bit difficult, but I do have lots to tell you about because the TLS is a co-sponsor or one of the sponsors of the Brooklyn Book Festival this week, and they're going to have a virtual festival day with literary panels over 40 authors on September the 25th, which is Sunday, I think. Some of the authors in attendance are Carmela Shamsi, Wasan Shire, Mohsin Hamid, Jessamine Chan, Marlon James. There's also live events if you're in New York. They've got people like Joyce Carol Oates, stalwart TLS contributor, Bill McKibben, also TLS contributor, Martin Espada, Jennifer Egan, Esmeralda Santiago. It's New York's largest literary festival. And they have a children's day, lots of virtual things, lots of real life things. So, you know, head on down to that if you can. Now, coming up on this week's show, who's allowed to be an elf, dwarf, or hobbit? But first, there's a play on at the Old Vic in London at the moment, still in preview, opening this week, which is already causing a bit of a stir. Not only because it has an Oscar winner starring in it, one Helen Hunt, part of an excellent cast, but also because the play itself is about the vexed subject of vaccination. But it's not what you expect. COVID-19 doesn't get a mention because it was written before COVID. It had its premiere in California in 2017. The author of this amazingly prescient work is Jonathan Spector, and we're delighted that Jonathan is joining us today to talk about his play, Eureka Day. Jonathan, thanks very much for coming on. It must be a very busy week for you.
It is a bit of a busy week. Yeah, we have just a few previews left and have press night on Friday. So are, you know, just in that stage of putting the sort of last touches on things.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to just jump in and say, can you tell us why you wanted to write a play about the issue of vaccination?
Sure. It was sort of a confluence of things. I was living in Berkeley, California at the time, which is a very, very progressive, probably the most liberal area in the United States, or certainly up there. And, you know, I had the experience a couple of times of being in conversation with friends or sort of acquaintances and people who like me had sort of good progressive politics and, you know, were very well educated and very smart. And I sort of thought we had essentially the same worldview, and then would discover that they either didn't vaccinate their kids or were very sort of skeptical of vaccines, and was so curious how it could be that, you know, we basically agreed about everything except in this one specific area, we seem to live in different realities. And at the time I had just, you know, had gotten a commission from a theater in Berkeley, and I wanted to write a play that would feel very Berkeley kind of for that audience. And so I thought this would be a good something to explore. And so just began as I often do, if it's appropriate for the subject, just kind of interviewing as a lot of people and talking to as many people as I could to kind of get their points of view and perspectives, and did a lot of research and then eventually began writing the play. And the other thing that had a big impact on the writing of the play is I was writing it in 2016 and kind of, you know, working through the first draft, I would say in the months leading up to the 2016 election. And, you know, when these ideas, you know, when sort of fake news was a term that was first kind of entering our vocabulary. But even then, I didn't, you know, I remember this very specific moment where I was at the auto body shop picking up my car. And I, you know, there was a conversation with another woman who was there talking to the guy who worked there. And as everyone was talking at that time about Trump, it was the only thing anybody was talking about, and with the whatever horrible thing Trump had done most recently. And I'm sort of joined their conversation. And then the guy who is like working on my car, you know, turns to us and is like, well, yeah, I mean, Trump isn't perfect, but Hillary Clinton murdered 27 people. So what are you going to do? And three of us sort of all like turned to him and are like, what are you talking about? And, you know, tried to sort of get him to tell us like where he got this from. And it became clear that he really believed this. And, you know, he was like, well, I don't know. I'm not political. It's just my wife is the one who knows about all this stuff. And she watches YouTube. And that was another moment of like, wow, it's this phenomena where people who you think are living in the world with you actually, you know, live in a completely separate reality. And of course now, you know, what, 6 years later, I think that phenomena is one we were all very, very familiar with. But at the time, it still felt quite bracing to encounter it. And I think that in some way informed the writing of the play as well.
It's like you found a kind of pressure point and kind of pushed at it, as it were, that our worldviews seem incredibly similar apart from at this one point. So let's investigate the toothache, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, like it would be like as a piece of theater, certainly in thinking about writing, you know, for that audience of the theater that commissioned it, you know, I knew it was going to be a very liberal audience. And so to me, to write for that audience, you know, it would not be interesting to write a play about climate change or gun control because
everyone would agree.
Yeah. And we would know that the people who disagreed were people that we don't like and respect and think are crazy. Whereas this was at least at the time, was a topic where it felt like there could be people just like you, but who experienced this differently. Of course, that's something that's sort of radically changed in the past, you know, since COVID. And at the time, you know, vaccine skepticism was not particularly correlated in a clean way with political partisan identity. Like there were vaccine skeptics on the left and the right, and they got there in different ways. But just knowing that somebody didn't vaccinate their kids did not necessarily tell you like what their political party was, in the way that knowing that somebody doesn't believe in climate change, you know, will tell you what their political party. Now that's all changed because of COVID, because of Trump, because of all of these things.
Here, it wouldn't still necessarily indicate, I mean, it might be an indicator, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to say if someone didn't vaccinate their kids, oh, okay, you think this and you vote for these people. I think it might be a bit less politically polarized here. But can you tell us how you set up the play then? Who's talking? What's happening with it?
The play is set in a very progressive private elementary school, elementary and middle school. And the characters are the board of directors of the school, or the executive committee, as they call it, and the head of school, the principal. The other thing that was happening at the time that I was writing the play is California in the United States, every state gets to make their own rules around school vaccinations, about what vaccinations are required to attend school and how rigorously they enforce that. And at the time, in I think it was 2015, California had among the most lax rules in the country. All it said is if you didn't want to vaccinate your kids, you just needed to fill out what they called a personal belief exemption. So you just needed to say, like, I don't believe in vaccines, and that was it. And then there was an outbreak of measles at Disneyland in, I believe, 2015. And that, you know, led to a big shift, and they changed the law after much contentious debate. And California then shifted to have among the strictest laws in the country for childhood vaccinations for schools. And so that was also kind of very much in the air at the time. And there were the phenomenon of some very, very progressive, sort of the most, what we would call like the crunchiest, like the most liberal sort of hippie-ish schools would also have very high unvaccinated rates of students. So that was, you know, so it's setting up this school that in some way kind of like at the center of that and navigating some of that.
And so the school board, they're talking about what they're going to do or what they want to do or what they believe they should do.
Yes, I think the play is attempting to, in some ways, get at that experience that I had of people who you think and who all themselves think they are sort of all the same and have the same values and believe, you know, they operate via consensus and believe in that, and then encounter this thing in which it's just sort of impossible to find a consensus around.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, so I haven't seen it yet, still in preview, but it's, as far as I can tell, you will tell me, you're the expert, but it's not a serious, I mean, these are very serious, very polarizing issues, but it's not a serious chin-stroking drama, is it? It's a comedy. How did you manage that?
It is a comedy. I don't know that I mean, I think I'm always, when I'm writing, I'm trying to, on some level, you know, amuse myself first, just to not get too bored and find the thing so wretched. So I wasn't sort of setting out trying to write a comedy. I was just trying to write a play that I felt like was, you know, portraying the kind of people I knew in this community in an authentic way. But I think there is something that can happen when you put the way people actually talk and actually behave on stage. It can sometimes be very funny. And I think that's sort of how it came about. I certainly wasn't setting out to write like, but it is, but there is, yeah, a big comic element. There's a, without giving too much away, there's a scene where at a certain point they decide, because they want to get more input from sort of the wider community of the school, that they're going to hold a kind of a town hall meeting via Facebook. You see the comments from the people in the community. And that scene tends to get a big reaction from the audience.
Yes.
In the way that I did not anticipate when I was first writing the play.
Well, because people now know the horror of seeing comments unroll in real time, presumably.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
It seems to me that you like to sort of keep all sorts of possibilities up in the air in your work, politics and comedy and drama and kind of shock and that, all that kind of thing. Is that a fair assessment?
I tend to begin, when I land on something that seems worth pursuing this play, I'm always sort of, it's usually formulated around some kind of question. And so it's just sort of trying to find all the different ways to explore that question and sort of try and use the play to, if not get an answer to it, at least kind of dig into it more fully.
Mm-hmm. To sort of look at it from every viewpoint, seriously and comically and kind of politically and from a human point of view.
What's so tricky about these kind of conversations is like this, all of that is certainly there. And talking about it in that way is also so disconnected from the sort of process of writing, which is so much about kind of like, for me at least, like you're just sort of like connecting one moment to the next in the scene and trying to kind of build this machine that will function.
I was going to ask, is there any kind of tradition that you feel that you're part of, that you're writing in, or are you making up a new one? Who are your literary guiding lights?
Yeah, I don't know. I certainly don't feel like I'm making up a new tradition. I mean, you know, some of my favorite American writers who are working right now are, you know, people like Anne Washburn or Annie Baker, or Brandon Jacob Jenkins, people who are, I think, are playful with their language or exploring form in various ways, are interested in both kind of a certain kind of naturalism and a certain kind of theatricality. But I think it's hard to know. I mean, we're all sort of an accumulation of like all of the things that we encounter in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. And so in Eureka Day, you don't come down on one side or the other, do you? Is that right? That must be a difficult balancing act.
I think the characters have strongly held points of view. And I think in a certain sense, the play does as well, but in terms of the way the action unfolds. But I do feel that there was something I was very conscious of in writing it, is I wanted to make sure that I was portraying the point of view that I don't hold in a way that feels authentic and fair. At the same time, to me, the worst outcome would be that somebody comes to see the play and walks away thinking, oh, maybe I shouldn't vaccinate my kids.
Everybody stops vaccinating immediately.
Right. So, I mean, luckily that the reality is, you know, having done a lot of research about this in the course of writing the play, when you talk to people who are kind of experts in this stuff, what they will tell you is that it's actually extremely difficult to change someone's point of view about vaccines. So I think the likelihood that a play is going to impact someone's behavior in that regard is quite minimal. At one point I was talking to this guy who was a public health doctor in Oregon, who in an area with a very high unvaccinated rate, who had gotten a bunch of government funding to do a program to really try and reach people. And there was, he was like a sort of documentary, it was featuring him. And I had spoken to him several years later after this had all happened and after I'd seen him in this documentary. And he said, yeah, I think my point of view on all this has changed a bit now from when we were doing that. I now think it's almost impossible to change people's mind about this. Like, the people who are like on the fence, you can kind of influence them. But once people have a strongly held point of view, you just, there's almost nothing you can do, which was, you know, it's quite depressing too. And what I also heard from other experts is that the only thing that changes people's point of view, again, pre-COVID, about measles or mumps or whatever it is when there's an outbreak in their community. And then who previously did not get vaccinated will get their kids vaccinated. Because part of it is the perceived risk is we don't see measles anymore. We don't see a few months ago, we don't see polio. So people just perceive the risk to be quite low because enough people are vaccinated that we don't see it.
Mm-hmm. So if it's set in a private school, as you say, in this very liberal area, that's quite a specific and quite a privileged slice of life, isn't it? That's within a fairly certain class that you're looking at those attitudes, because there will be different attitudes, presumably within different classes as well. Was that because you just wanted to use the people that you had talked to and that experience?
No, it was, I mean, there was a practical part of it, which is that the private schools have more leeway to set their own policy than the public schools.
Oh, I see, right, yeah.
But the more substantive reason was that the core of the debate around, you know, childhood vaccinations and different points of view comes down to this idea of like the individual versus the community, the sort of getting to have your individual choice and doing what you feel like is right for you versus doing something that is right for everybody. And that same in the play does sort of point at this specifically, like there's an analog to that in the choice to send your child to a private school. And there's an inherent contradiction in the existence of private schools that see themselves as oriented towards social justice and being progressive, because of course, like the most progressive thing you could do is not send your child to a private school. That contradiction felt like metaphorically and kind of practically like a useful one to kind of tie up in all of this.
Mm-hmm. And has the play changed? Have you changed it at all in the light of COVID or not? Is it just exactly the same as it was? Because you must have been watching this thinking, oh, okay, well, this is different.
Not in a substantive way. I mean, I've tweaked some lines just to, you know, a rehearsal with a play. You think, oh, that moment, you know, doesn't quite work as good as it should. Let me change that line. But I haven't changed anything for COVID or as a result of kind of the world shifting.
So the issues, they're still the local ones, as it were, about measles or mumps, or, you know, there's no pandemic in it, as it were.
No. The play is set very clearly in 2017. I feel like it would be unbearable if it were about COVID. Who would want to go see a play about COVID? Yeah.
Well, also it would be a big rewrite. I just wondered if you had felt like you had to kind of acknowledge it, but I see if it's set there. And so then bringing it to Europe, you don't want to make it European because it's very specifically about this bit of America at this time. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's true. And it certainly, and it's been very gratifying, even in the, you know, we've had about 2 weeks of previews and to see the audience is responding to it and seems to get it so well. I mean, really, even after that, it was a question I had from that very first production we did in California, because it was a play, you know, set in the community that it was being performed in. And, you know, people responded very positively to it. But I didn't have any idea to what degree that was simply because people were seeing their own community on stage and whether connect to it in other places. And now it's, you know, it's been performed all around the United States and in Australia. And, you know, and so it's quite gratifying to see that people seem to connect to it, even though it's set in this very specific place in this very specific time.
Well, we have had similar kind of localized versions of it. There's probably a different one in every country, isn't there, about a slightly different illness. It's an issue and has been for a while, and you've pinpointed it, as it were. Presumably it changes, the feel of it changes a bit with each new cast. Have you been like in rehearsals with the new cast? Are you still tweaking and rewriting a little? I mean, not now, because you're in previews, but were you?
I wouldn't say not now.
Maybe now.
the actors may wish I wasn't at this point, but we do have a couple, you know, like two new lines we want to put in today. But luckily, I've been able to be here for most of the process. I was here for the first 2 weeks, and then I came back for the last week before we started previews. So I've been able to be around for quite a bit of it to be able to just keep kind of massaging it, you know, and some of that is just moments that, you know, that you never quite work the way you want them to and trying to perfect it. And some of it is the thing of plays, which is that you, where you're in a process and you're working on it and you're making small adjustments, and some of what you're doing sometimes consciously or not is adjusting a line so that it sort of lands best in the mouth of a certain actor. And so then when you have different actors, you're like, oh, actually, no, let me tweak that for you just so that it feels better, you know, coming out of your mouth. And so there's a little bit of that. It's kind of both like the frustration and joy of playwriting is that you can never really, you know, you can never really perfect it because it's only really can be perfected like for a certain set of people making the play.
But logistically, do you do that every time? Are you able to do that every time? Because you have a different director and stuff every time, or could you just do it with some productions?
In the first production, I was doing, you know, quite a bit of kind of all the way through, which is fairly typical. And then there was another production, the production in New York, which I was quite involved with, although I didn't do a ton of rewriting. And then this production, I've gone to see some of the other productions, but I haven't been really involved in them. And I think this will probably be the last production that I am in this deep with. At a certain point, you do have to just kind of let it go. But this is such a, you know, it's such an incredible group of people, and it's such a, you know, to be at the Old Vic. So I really wanted to be able to kind of fully be a part of it.
Well, it sounds completely fascinating. And as we said, it's opening officially on Friday, isn't it? The 23rd, is that right?
Yeah.
Correct. And so thank you so much, Jonathan, for talking to us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Still to come on the show, elves, dwarves, trolls, dragons, lords, and rings. Yes, you guessed it, it's the latest iteration of Tolkien's world. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Now, you may have noticed, since the beginning of September, some modest announcements of a small TV series based on a little-known book called The Lord of the Rings. It is, of course, almost impossible that you haven't noticed it, since it's been flagged, advertised, marketed, and now discussed almost relentlessly, and we're still only 4 episodes in. We've given the dust some time to settle and then asked someone who's been working and teaching on this for over 10 years to give us her expert view. So we're delighted to welcome Dimitra Femi, Senior Lecturer in Fantasy and Children's Literature and Co-Director of the Centre for Fantasy and the Fantastic at Glasgow University, to unpack it all for us. Dimitra, many thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this has all been flagged for a while, as I said, hasn't it? There's been a lot of run-up, and you say in your piece that you had mixed feelings about it. Can you tell us why?
Well, there's been a long run, as you said. We've known about this for a long time. We've known since the rights were resold. And of course, the Amazon Studios kept the whole thing very, very closely secret. So there were no major leaks or anything like this. So the anticipation has been building for a long time. I suppose my trepidation, as with any adaptation, is will they strike the right balance? I suppose I was also worried about will it be quite derivative, you know, quite similar to other things we've seen, because fantasy as a big part of the film and TV industry is becoming bigger and bigger. And there are templates now, you know, thinking about the success of Game of Thrones, for example, or the previous Lord of the Rings films, you know, would they stick to some of the same tropes, or would they try to do something a bit braver and bolder and different, you know, aesthetically? But also, I suppose, you know, being a Tolkien specialist, I knew there would be, you know, there will be bits that I will enjoy, and there would be bits that I would probably find quite difficult to stomach, because it's knowing the world too well. I suppose every reader, you know, that would go for everyone. Every reader has their own understanding and reading the text. You know, there is no one interpretation ever.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, you know this field incredibly well in great detail, but and you were already concerned before it came out about what some reactions to the diverse casting would be, because it became clear before it came out that there was diverse casting, didn't it? And alas, you were right. Can you unpack this a bit for us? I mean, basically, you knew this was going to happen, didn't you?
Well, we knew that when back in, I think it was January or February, they released, actually, it was quite interesting what they did. They released a few posters of actors' hands holding particular objects, and we could see a bit of their dress, a bit of a, you know, what they were wearing, and a few objects. So it's a bit of material culture, I suppose. But of course, it was pretty obvious right there at the beginning that not all of those hands were white hands, and that there were non-white sort of actors involved, and obviously also in positions that were quite central in terms of main characters, etc. Which to me was actually really lovely to see. You know, this is part of what I was ready to applaud in terms of how this adaptation, you know, what direction it would take things. I wasn't that surprised, but still quite disappointed and sad to see the sort of backlash of Middle Earth is all white, how dare you? And also, you know, this very, very problematic dichotomy of, you know, all the good characters are mostly white, all the bad characters are mostly non-white, which is a line that Tolkien does have, and it is a problematic line. And, you know, as I said, I'm glad that the adaptation is sort of going beyond that and sort of complicating this dichotomy. But clearly, a sector of the fandom got quite upset about that, and some of the comments were, there's no other way to describe it. You know, they were pretty racist and horrible.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I was talking to Alex about this when we were preparing it. It's a shame she can't be with us today, but she was saying, look, if you believe that it's an elf, how could it possibly make any difference to you what colour the elf is? Do you know what I mean? It's
totally.
It's already a big leap of faith if you go, okay, that's an elf, that's a dwarf, that's a hobbit.
Absolutely. It's already an imaginary world. We're not talking
about,
you know, a realistic representation anyway. But still, you know, even if we impose the same rules that we would with realism, think about what theatre or film or TV has done with historical figures who have been represented as non-white for a long, long time now. You know, there's a long trend of this. And it is about belonging, and it is about sort of questioning wrongs, really, of the past. I remember when, you know, that first debate started, I was tweeting and I was reminding people about, you know, non-white actors playing Prometheus, you know, in the 80s or 90s, or actually a Victorian actor who was a Black Victorian actor playing Shakespeare back in the 19th century. You know, there's a long tradition of that, you know, and don't get me,
of course,
on sort of statues of Christ at different churches presented as Black. None of that is new. There's nothing new about it. And that's, I think, part of the shock of many people, where, okay, well, why is that any different?
I was wondering why people are so kind of protective and so literal about it. Do you think it's because it's often something that people encounter when they're children?
There's an element of that, but I think it's more than this. I think that Tolkien, for a section of the fandom, is sort of a sacred text.
Yeah.
The Lord of the Rings, the entire legendarium, has been elevated to the status of a sacred text. And it's sort of, you know, it's crossing that line, you know.
Right. So you're not allowed to change anything at all.
the terminology I was, was nearly, you know, that of violating sort of religious line. And of course, you know, we know about Tolkien was, of course, a devout Catholic. Again, you know, that is pretty well known and evidenced. But that means that there's also a section of the fandom that actually sticks to that as an absolute rule about everything. And that is what defines, you know, for them, his work. And again, you know, these lines, when they get crossed, it becomes something more than just fiction for certain people.
Yes, it's something to do with childhood and them not wanting something that they treasure from their childhood to change at all, even if actually the change is, in fact, very positive.
Yeah, sure. There's definitely an element of nostalgia, or sort of, I wanted to be like it was in my head sort of thing, right? But again, that sort of bypasses the recognition of the fact that what you've got, you know, in what you imagine in your head, you know, how you imagine these characters in your head is part of, you know, your own worldview and your own ideological background. It's, you know, the way you grew up and the way you understand the world around you. That doesn't mean that everybody understands the world around them in the same way. This is part of a global audience. Really.
Yeah,
has been a lot of in Tolkien scholarship and in fandom. That definitely in the last 10 years there has been much more visibility of fans of Tolkien from all over the world, especially non-white fandom, and also fans that identify as LGBTQ+, you know, who are also saying, actually, we are also enjoying this text. We also read ourselves in this text, and you know, why should we be stopped from doing this?
Mm-hmm. So what do you think then of the show? There's a big question. What do you think of the show itself?
Well, as I was saying in my review, it still feels like, you know, it's early days. There's lots of storylines that I've no idea where they're going with. So, you know, I'm going to have to sort of come back and do another one at the end of the series.
Sure.
What I'm enjoying at the moment is the world building. You know, I'm really enjoying the fact that we're going to places in Middle Earth that we haven't seen represented on stage before, and where the creators have this blank canvas to sort of create material cultures. And that's where I think they're doing some amazing work. So seeing Numenor in the third episode was brilliant. Those scenes at the prologue where we see Valinor as it was before the trees are destroyed. You know, these are the mythological places and times, you know, the chronotopes, the space-time in Tolkien's world that up to now we've never seen represented. And these are huge, titanic, sort of epic moments in the mythology. So it's really, really lovely to see those. I also like the fact that we do see characters that we know from later times now in a slightly different stage of their lives and having different priorities and different motivations. I found some moments jarring, but generally it's nice to see Galadriel at an earlier age, you know, to see her more rebellious and more sort of, you know, having more agency than the white lady sitting, you know, in a secluded space in Lothlorien in The Lord of the Rings. Having said that, there's also elements where I'm thinking, oh, okay, that's going a bit too far for me. But again, these will be personal reactions and personal sort of subjective understandings of characters. I think sometimes language I found a bit jarring. So I talk in my piece about accents. What I didn't have space to talk about is it was also terminology. You know, at times I'm thinking, Celebrimbor was talking about his project to create a forge. I was like, oh, just the word project doesn't sound right. It sounds too corporate and sort of...
Yes, yeah, like he needs a project manager to deal with it.
So at times I've sort of picked on little details. I'm like, oh, don't give me that word now. Find a better one, you know, just make it fit.
I have to say the script, I believe it got better, but the script in the first one... Mm. I know they had to do a lot of exposition, but I thought it was quite kind of stilted. Do you know what I mean? It didn't flow.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a lot of people standing and explaining things to each other in semi-formal language.
Yeah, and I suppose, as you say, there had to be an element of that in terms of establishing peoples and storylines and sort of giving background. But I think you're right. I think as we went on into the following chapters, we do get better dialogue. Although at times also I felt that it's interesting you call it stilted, but at times this sort of more formal language of the elves I found more fitting than when, you know, you start getting Galadriel very arrogant by the third and fourth.
Yes. It wasn't so much the fact that they speak kind of quite formally, because you might, you know, you sort of might expect that a bit. It was just that it almost wasn't like a dialogue. Some of it would be like, I am going to say my line about what happened in history. And then I'm going to say my line about what happened in history. It seemed a little, not the actor's fault. The actors were very good. It seemed that the dialogue wasn't a kind of flow or a, you know, a give and take. You said an interesting thing about the use of the species names. Can you tell us about that point?
That, I thought, was a bit of a bad hangover from the Peter Jackson films. So I really don't understand why. I get the point that you want to play up the rivalry between dwarves and elves because that's what people would recognize from previous films or, you know, from the texts up to a point. But why should, you know, Galadriel be or Elrond be referred to as you elf, you know, in front of them, you know, in that sort of derogatory way? It just doesn't happen in the texts at all, not in that way. You wouldn't, you wouldn't use that term. It sounds derogatory. It sounds like, you know, you're putting somebody in a category to denigrate them. Peter Jackson did it a few times, but I think this is taken to an extreme here. And it makes me flinch every, it makes me cringe every time I hear it. Actually, I think it needs to be dropped and used either very sparingly at particular moments or to be dropped. It just doesn't, ring right.
But as you say, the visual element, there's some amazing shots, which presumably is, I don't know how much of it's CGI and how much of it's real landscape, but there's amazing things that look like drone shots from on high.
Yes.
Some kind of wonderful things that make you feel a bit sick almost because they kind of dip down into a valley and it looks very beautiful, but it's quite a similar aesthetic, isn't it, to the films? You made this point. It's a kind of Art Nouveau, Arthurian almost. It's a kind of pre-Raphaelite thing, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. And again, I think this is part of that has to do with, you know, which is the conceptual artistic team. And it seems like there's quite a bit of continuity between the two. So the Elvish realms look very similar to the aesthetic we had at the Peter Jackson films. I think I was more interested in the Khazad Dûm, for example, in Moria, which now is fleshed out and it's actually a living realm rather than this abandoned space that we see in the Jackson films. And also the Valinor, obviously, again, is a bit of a blank canvas there, but Numenor is the one that is quite fascinating in the sense that we haven't been there before and they seem to have brought together different cultural elements from possibly Egypt, the Mediterranean. I mean, the Numenoreans are a mishmash of cultures in Tolkien's work already. You know, we have, you know, he talked about them as, you know, sort of a Roman Empire in its decline, or, you know, the Egyptians with their sort of reverence for death and embalming. But at the same time, the mariners, they are, you know, there's elements of sort of Viking seafaring in the way that they, you know, in their relationship with the sea. And some of those elements I started seeing, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that. And what's fascinating to me is how much of the scholarship actually the team are aware of, because all of these I'm wondering, because all of these elements that we're seeing represented on the screen have been discussed for a few decades now and have been taken apart and, you know, picked apart. So I'm waiting to see more. I think the scale also, at the moment I'm working on one of my new projects for the next book is on miniature fantasies and fantasies of little people and, you know, scale and smallness in children's fantasy in particular. I really liked how the Harfoots, the ancestors of the hobbits, are portrayed and how scale is being used there to show them a little. Because the only person we see them against is the stranger, who we don't know who he is, but obviously, you know, of a mannish sort of stature. He does look very big. But it's those first scenes where we see the little hobbits stealing blackberries.
The berries, yeah.
And the berries are huge in their hands, and you suddenly realise, oh, look, okay, yeah, I can see the scale here. These are not little berries on a human hand. These are huge berries on a little hand, and that worked quite nicely, I thought.
Yeah, that was nice. I meant to ask you, actually, in terms of you're talking about the scholarship, can you just sketch out for us what they are allowed to do, as it were, what the writers have access to and what they don't have access to? Because it's reasonably, well, it's not that complicated, but it's interesting.
It is and it isn't. Yeah. What went out for sale were the same material that the Jackson films had. So the whole of The Lord of the Rings, the whole of The Hobbit, and including the appendices of The Lord of the Rings. So that's the stuff that was sold during Tolkien's lifetime and no more, not an inch more than that. And that's what the estate have decided to sort of stick with. So they have, in terms of the period that they're setting this in, they have the appendices and that's what they've got. But of course, all of Tolkien fans and scholars know that all of this material is much, much more expanded, developed, told in much more detail in other publications, like The Silmarillion, like Unfinished Tales, like the 12-volume History of Middle-earth, in which we see all the versions of all of those stories, etc. But they can't use any of that. So they have to stick to I was trying to find an analogy. I think in the piece I'm talking about the Doctor Who analogy, right? So there's so much that the Doctor can do with human history. He can sort of meddle with it up to a point, or she, but they can't, you know, change the big points, right? So in some ways, they're in the same territory. They have to stick to the larger storyline. So Numenor will fall. You know, they can't change that. Sauron will come back. They can't change that. Bigger turning points have to be kept. But they have the freedom to do stuff differently leading up to those points potentially, or maybe tweak things. Talking to students recently, there's nothing new about that either, right? Again, talking about this as a sacred text. The Athenians in classical Athens who sat down to watch the tragedies of Sophocles and Aeschylus and Euripides, they knew the story, but they also knew the tweaks. They, you know, famously, Medea, Euripides' Medea, she doesn't kill the children in most of the mythological texts. That was his innovation. So this idea of, you know, watching something that you know the main points of, but will be done somehow differently, is a very, very old practice in our culture. It's, you know, it's this sort of emphasis in originality of the 20th century that we've sort of seemed to be particularly stuck with at times, but it's a very, very old tradition. So yes, they can play with the material as long as these big turning points are kept and are respected. But, you know, the more we're watching those first four episodes, the more you realize actually the stuff that they seem to have alluded to that aren't in the appendices but are in other materials. So what is going on there? I don't know. One big example is the map of Numenor. So the map of Numenor shouldn't be in the material they have. It's only been published in Unfinished Tales. But they are using the map of Numenor as it appeared in Unfinished Tales. So it's not clear whether can they ask for permission for smaller things on a case-by-case basis? Are there subsidiary agreements? None of this is in the public sphere at the moment. But I've started noticing things that I'm like, oh, wait a minute, that's not in any of the formal material. So what's going on there? I don't know yet. I think we'll find out.
Interesting. So there is a little bits of other things creeping in. So what they're doing now is the bit basically a long time before The Lord of the Rings.
Yes, they're living the Second Age. There's still a long time before even that, but they're doing sort of
there's ages. But does that mean that, you know, after I don't know how many episodes, that they can then also do the story of The Lord of the Rings as we know it?
Sure they can, of course. I mean,
so they can they're going to redo that, do you think?
They might or they might not. At the moment it's not clear. I'm wondering how far this first season will go. You know, will they go all the way to, it's not that long. So will we end up with a revelation of who Sauron is and his appearance? In which case, then we have a whole other series getting up to the point where, you know, the Numenoreans are corrupted. I'm wondering whether their end vision end point at the moment is to end exactly where the Jackson film started, or whether they're going to go on and do that. There's no indication at the moment of how far this is going to go, but they could, you know, there's nothing to stop them from redoing the Lord of the Rings story. And again, right. I've said this publicly before, and I'm not going to give too much detail here, but I was involved with a rival bid when the rights went out for sale. So I know that other ideas were just a retelling of the Lord of the Rings in a different way. So that was on the table as a possibility by other people.
Okay. Oh, interesting. So I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are you going to keep watching?
Oh, sure, I'll keep watching. And I will take ruthless notes and I will talk about everything I like and everything I don't. That's what we do, you know, that's what we do. That's the way that we, as scholars and as academics, engage with this process. It is an adaptation and there will be bits that will be interesting. There will be bits that I will not like, and that's fine. But if anything, you know, this is a chance to sort of, to get to talk about more obscure parts of the legendarium with a wider public. You know, people are asking questions. People want to know more. My students want to know more. You know, so of course I will keep on engaging. Sure.
Brilliant. Well, maybe we'll get you back probably every year to find out the update in the next 10 years. We'll see you a few times yet. Sure. Dimitra, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Jonathan Spector and Dimitra Femi. And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy. We'll be back next week, but for now, goodbye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.